The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
America, bonjour, hi, Canada, Hugh Hewitt. It's live on Friday, February the 20th, in a year of our Lord, 2022. President Biden has landed in Seoul, Korea, to begin his Asian swing, and we will also keep our eye on Pennsylvania. Today should be a big day in the showdown between Dave McCormick and Dr. Oz, both within 1,312 votes. Dr. Oz leading right now, 1,316 vote lead. But there are 13,000 absentee ballots out, an untold number of votes not counted in Allegheny County that will be counted today. And then the absentee military ballots, which can, and late arriving military ballots, which can show up until Tuesday of next week, whatever the post, if the postmark is correct on the day that they were mailed. So this one won't be over, but we'll get a lot of clarity today as most of the absentees and the uncounted votes in Allegheny County will finally be tallied. We'll know what the real look is. We're in automatic recount territory. A candidate can decline the automatic recount. At 1,316 votes, if there are 13,000 absentees out there and they break as they have, McCormick will win. If there are 8,700, as some rando in the Secretary of State office said, that makes it hard for McCormick to win absent a mail-in military ballot, which they're counting on a significant advantage in, given McCormick's Bronze Star and 82nd Airborne credentials. I'll keep you posted throughout the day on Twitter. Not much else to tell you this morning. I want to play for you one clip for sure. Leader McConnell yesterday was on with Brett Baer last night and talking about the baby formula shortage. And he said what I've been telling you for days, but I like it when the leader tells it to Brett Baer on Special Report, cut number 28.
Almost total incompetence. They misjudged this from the beginning. It's not a matter of money. The FDA has a $6 billion budget. They could certainly take care of the so-called appropriation in the House that they just passed at $28 million. Bureaucratic incompetence. The administration was behind the curve. FDA needs to step up their game, and hopefully we'll solve this problem very quickly.
Yeah, I love that. It's just the FDA needs to step up their game. It's about the FDA. The United States Senate passed. The president has signed the $40 billion in aid to Ukraine. U.S. missiles are being considered for sale to European allies, Harpoon missiles that could end the Black Sea blockade of Ukrainian wheat that the entire country needs. A Pentagon official told the New York Times that Russian troops have been forced to fight in smaller formations in the eastern area of Ukraine known as the Donbas because they're getting shattered by Western artillery that's arrived. Just imagine if we had done this last year. It might have deterred everything. The stock market nastiness would have not happened. The big election in the world, and this matters to you and me, is in Australia tomorrow. This matters to everyone listening because ScoMo, as they call him, Scott Morrison, and the Conservatives run Australia right now. They've entered into the four-way defense agreement, India, Australia, Japan, and the United States. And we need a good, strong government in Canberra. Here's a little bit of Scott Morrison when he was the number two guy on the front bench before he became prime minister. He gets asked a question. Just play the Scott Morrison clip, please.
The member for Canning.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Treasurer. Will the Treasurer outline to the House what the government is doing to ensure that Australia has a strong economy that creates jobs and reduces cost of living pressures? How does a competitive economy help hardworking Australians get ahead, especially in regional parts of Australia like Canning?
The Treasurer is Morrison. Go ahead, play.
This is Carl. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
Stop for that. He brought up to the podium a huge chunk of coal. If you're watching on the Salem News Channel, you can see. Now, that's not allowed. He just broke the rules. You're not supposed to have props. It's not the United States Senate where you can have charts. But he brought up a huge, if you're watching on the Salem News Channel, You see, I've got my Northwestern mug. It's bigger than that. All right. It's purple here, but he brings up a big, huge thing of coal. All right. Go ahead.
The Treasurer has the call.
Mr. Speaker, this is coal. Don't be afraid.
The Treasurer knows the rule on crops.
It's coal. It was dug up by men and women who work and live in the electorates of those who sit opposite. From the Hunter Valley, as the member for Hunter would know. It's coal that has ensured for over 100 years
the Deputy
that Australia
Prime Minister
has enjoyed an energy competitive advantage that has delivered prosperity to Australian businesses and has ensured that Australian industry has been able to remain competitive on a global market. Mr. Speaker, those opposite have an ideological, pathological fear of coal. There's no word for coalophobia officially, Mr. Speaker, but that's the malady that afflicts those opposite. But it's that malady,
coalophobia. And I think that Scott Morrison deserves a second run. Now, he's been through COVID, and he was very unpopular. There's no country in the world tougher to lock down than Australia. Many of the United States not only wanted to go into lockdown, they don't want to come out now that, you know, COVID is manageable. Especially for those who get their two vaccines and two boosters. We've got therapeutics now. Lots of people have natural immunity from having had COVID. I got a neighbor here inside the Beltway who he and I are trying to work out a homeowners association issue, and I can't meet with him. Good guy, but he's got COVID. And so I've offered to bring him stuff on his step. But, you know, COVID is around. It's surging in places, but it's not the deadly Delta variant. We've got a bunch better immunity, both natural and boosted throughout the United States. So nobody's pausing. But Morrison still has to deal with an electorate after COVID. So we'll see what happens tomorrow. In Russia, prices are soaring and their economy's trashed. I feel bad for the average Russian who knows that Putin is a creep and a killer. Dr. Michael Oren is going to join us later because I don't know how Israeli politics, you know, they have 120 member Knesset. That's their legislature. And you've got to have 61 votes to pass anything. And the coalition that ousted Bibi Netanyahu last year is down to 59. They keep losing like the Black Knight in Monty Python. They lost another member yesterday. So I don't know how that goes on. Washington Post headline, U.S. may be barreling towards recession in the next year, more experts say. The U.S. economy could be heading for recession, writes Abba Batarl. According to the growing warnings from banks and economists, as a sudden bout of pessimism hammers financial markets. A new marker yesterday, gas has hit $4 a gallon in all 50 states. In California, $6.29 a gallon for regular. I'm thinking about someone stuck on the 55 and the 91 coming in from Moreno Valley over to the coast, or someone coming down from Santa Barbara or the 101 into L.A., and certainly those very long commutes up into the city or Silicon Valley, $6.29 a gallon. You know, yesterday, Joe Biden invoked the Defense Production Act for baby formula to make it easier to make baby formula. I think he should invoke the Defense Production Act to make more gasoline. Has anyone asked him that in the press corps? I'll ask Michael Scheer that. You know, it was a big deal, the DNP, the DPA, Defense Production Act for baby formula. Why not the DPA for gasoline? I mean, if it's magic, let's use the magic, right? Oklahoma lawmakers passed a ban on abortion. It's near total. And I don't understand what Nick Saban and Jimbo Fisher are arguing about. The SEC, this is just lovely. In Ohio, people just want to play for Ohio State, regardless of name, image, and likeness money. They just want to play for the Buckeyes because it's the best program in the United States, and they're going to win about four championships in a row with Ryan Day and team. So I Nick Saban and Jimbo Fisher want to go all WWE. That's fine with me, but it's a big story in college football. More coming up after the break on the Friday edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show. Stay with me.
Say goodbye to Hollywood. Say goodbye, my baby. Say goodbye to Hollywood. Say goodbye, my baby.
I guess we're not going to say goodbye to Hollywood because I love the Duke so much that my guest, Sonny Bunch, I chided him. I urged him to go. And if they will keep making movies like The Duke, people over the age of 50 will keep going to little movies and keep them going. Good morning, Sonny Bunch. How are you? Did you go see The Duke yet?
I did not, Hugh, because it's not really playing anywhere near me. It's only in a handful of theaters. So I wasn't able to go see it. But you were very big on it. Tell the people what I'm missing out on.
What you're missing on is a small movie that deserves a large audience. Helen Mirren, and now I'm blanking on his name. Help me with the character actor from England, who has done 1,000 character actor bits. It's a true story of the stealing by a member of the public of the Duke of Marlborough from the British Museum. I think it was around 1965, who was mad about the BBC TV tax. And it's just wonderfully cast, acted. And you know what I say about the best movies? They take you to a place in time that you can't go. Well, here you are in post-war England in 1964. And it's kind of grim, Sonny. It's less than 20 years after the war is bombed out. There's not many jobs. There's not much hope going around. There's a lot of sadness and a lot of despair. And it's really a movie about grief. And I think movies about grief are very difficult to do and beautiful when they're carried off. Broad Street. And so the fact is, small movies, I love them. It's a grown-up movie. There are no special effects, although they recreate 1964, 65, London and Birmingham and the yards pretty well. I think you'll love Helen Mirren. That's what I really think you'll love. Jim Broadbent.
That's what I was gonna. It looks good. It looks interesting. I mean, it definitely looks better than Anatomy of a Scandal, which I watched on Netflix, which is a British show, a British series about a kind of a fictional scandal in a political environment that is so bad, Hugh. I cannot recommend.
Oh, warn me, because I watch everything British. What's its name again? I'll write it down.
Anatomy of a Scandal. You don't want to waste your time on this one. It's incredibly, incredibly bad. Just
how do they trick you into it? Do they have one of the great British actor or actresses in it?
No, it's got one of the actresses from Downton Abbey is the female lead, and Rupert Friend is the male lead.
No, that's the trick. It's Downton Abbey trick. That's going to trick my wife for about 30 years.
I mean, also Sienna Miller is in it. I like the cast is okay. The cast is okay. This is, I think, what got my wife, frankly, to want to watch it was the cast. But man, it is.
Downton Abbey is sort of like a zombie eating machine. It turns certain people into zombies. They see it and they must move to the screen.
Yeah. Speaking of which, I mean, there's a new Downton Abbey movie out. I asked my wife. I was like, "Do you want to go see it? And I'll go with you. We'll go together. Because otherwise, I'll be totally lost. I won't understand any of it. And I don't. There's no reason for me to go if you're not going to go with me." She's like, "Nah, I don't really want to," which was interesting to me. I was kind of surprised. I don't know if...
Has she been in a rehab clinic? Fetching Mrs. Hewitt wants to be there yesterday. By the way, this is not a gender thing, because both of my boys love it, too. I just am kind of over it. It's been going on forever, right? It's a soap opera.
Yeah, it's been on a long time. It's a soap. It's very soap opery. I mean, I saw the first movie in theaters. It was the only experience I've had with the Downton Abbey phenomenon, and it was kind of fine, I guess. The trailer for this one, and I'm going to make the horrible cardinal sin of a critic and review something based on the trailer. But just watching the trailer of it, it starts off with such. What's the right word? Wealth porn, kind of?
Yeah, well, that's what the Gilded Age, Downton Abbey, I'm going to contradict myself. I said I love movies that take you to a time and place that you cannot go, like Lincoln. And Downton Abbey did that pre-war, post-war, World War I. I don't need to go back again. I've seen it. I don't want to live in that house. It's cold and damp, and I don't like to eat on the sideboard. And by the way, the servants are miserable.
But that's what's different about this, right? The way the trailer starts, like, Maggie Grace, I guess, the older lady
Dane.
Thank you. She starts off the trailer with, "Many years ago, I met a man briefly, and he has gifted me a villa in the south of France." And then the shots in the trailer are all these shots of a place in the French seafront town that they're going to be spending the whole time in. So it's not even in Downton Abbey, as best as I can tell.
Oh, they're making a picture in Downton Abbey, so the bad Hollywood, the grimy Hollywood people come. Tell us about something that people can go see.
Well, you know, again, it's a very slow weekend, Hugh. It's a very slow weekend because everybody was getting out of the way on the one hand of Doctor Strange 2 weekends ago, and coming up next weekend, of course, is Top Gun Maverick. Top Gun Maverick comes out Memorial Day weekend. That's kicking off. Everyone is very excited for that, but I think folks were also scared of that movie. So it's another slow weekend at the box office. I went and saw, and this is just, it's not going to be a movie you're going to want to see. I'm going to just warn you off of it right now. I don't want to get the dreaded failure to warn, but there's a movie out now called Men. It's a horror film starring Jesse Buckley as a woman who is grieving the loss of her husband. But grieving is the wrong word. Her husband killed himself. He was abusive, and she was going to divorce him, and he threatened to kill himself, and then he went through with it. And the whole movie is essentially, I didn't hate it exactly, but I was vaguely exasperated about it because what it feels like is sitting through an argument on Twitter where people talk about, you know, in the kind of broadest Twitter terms, like the problems with men. What's wrong with men? That's basically the subtitle of this movie. Men, what's wrong with them? And it does this interesting thing where
isn't that MSNBC?
Basically, yeah. It does this kind of interesting thing where one actor, his name is Rory Kinnear, plays all of the men in the movie, more or less. He plays the landlord in the house that Jesse Buckley's character is rented. He plays a police officer who kind of doubts her, has suspicions about her stories. He plays a naked man wandering around the village stalking her. He plays some local toughs. He plays a kind of punk kid who is mean to her. And the idea here, right, is that all men are basically the same underneath, that all men are they're all, you know, gaslighting the women, and they're all mansplaining, and they're all one of them plays a vicar who suggests, you know, she drove her husband to suicide. You know, all men are bad, basically, is the lesson of
it. I'm not gonna go see that movie.
You're not gonna want to see this, and it has very strong horror elements. There's a lot of kind of scary stuff towards the end of this movie. You're not gonna want it.
It
has interesting folk horror elements to it, if you know much about British or, you know, kind of broader European mythology. There's some interesting stuff.
I don't care, but I have a question for you, if you have time, for just to add a left field question.
Sure.
I am binge watching Ozark season 4, Jason Bateman. And I'm amazed at Jason Bateman because for a man so expressionless, he acts very well. Where did he come from?
Jason Bateman's been around a long time. I mean, he was in.
I know,
two.
But
that's where I remember first seeing Jason Bateman when I was, like, you know, 8 years old, and Teen Wolf 2 came out. He was the You remember the movie Teen Wolf, right, with Michael J. Fox?
I did not see it, but I remember it. Yes.
Yeah. Sure. So in Teen Wolf 2, it's the same basic idea, except it's you know, the Teen Wolf's cousin, and he's in Britain. And he's, I believe, a boxer instead of a basketball player. But no, he definitely he bounced around the industry for a while. And I would say that the thing that made him break out was Arrested Development, the Fox show. I mean, that's where he in the early 2000s he bursts back onto the scene with Arrested Development, the story of the Bluth family, and his kind of affect, his blank. You know, very deadpan sort of acting was perfect
control.
For that movie. I mean, just
control.
Absolutely.
Is there a predicate for that? I mean, have we ever had a, quote, star, close quote, whose affect is expressionlessness emotion?
I think you see it every once in a while. I think you see it more now than you used to. I mean, it depends on what we want to describe as affectless or blank, right? I mean, I do think that there's a case to be made for Paul Newman kind of having that very cool exterior, right? That's not exactly affectless, but it is a coolness that approaches quietude. And I think that you get that occasionally. Like Ryan Gosling is kind of like that. He's a very quiet and still.
Yeah, it's interesting, Sonny. 30 years ago, the LA Times asked 50 people if you had to explain to a European America using three movies and they'd never been here, which three would you use? And I suggested Caddyshack, The Basketball Story, Hoosiers, and Cool Hand Luke, because I thought Paul Newman 30 years ago had defined a generation of American men.
Yeah. I mean, and in that movie, look, again, I wouldn't say affectless is the right way to describe him in Cool Hand Luke, but there's definitely an aloofness that
stoic
borders on, cold quietness that really kind of defines what makes him work in that. And some other stuff. I mean, again, Paul Newman had a lot of range and a lot of different modes. So,
but stoicism, that's why Sonny Bunch is the official movie critic. We're going to restore all of your lost airline miles from whatever it is you failed to warn me about, because that was a fine set of back and forth unanticipated. Sonny Bunch on Twitter, his two podcasts, Across the Movie Aisle and The Bulwark Goes to the Movie. You should be listening to them every week. That's The Bulwark Goes to the Movie and Across the Movie Aisle. Sonny Bunch on Twitter. Thank you, Sonny. America, don't go anywhere on the Hugh Hewitt Show. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Time now on the Hugh Hewitt Show for the Poet Laureate of the Hugh Hewitt Show, Tarzana Joe. Hello, Joe.
Hello, Hugh. Well, it's election season again, or perhaps election season always. And that's what the poem's about. The primaries have started, and the general is looming. Business for the pundits and politicos is booming. We're always in a campaign mode. That's the news that's trending. There's no election cycle, just a run that's never ending. Yes, some would say the founders would find this standing stunning and write op-ed opinions opposing all this running. For president, 1 6-year term, move senators to 8, and each 4 years we'd fill the House. Now, wouldn't that be great? But with our fine technology from sea to shining sea, with all such propositions, I deeply disagree. The plan that I'm proposing and whose virtues I'm extolling aims to set a framework for extreme and frequent polling. Whether there's a crisis or just a slowish news day, I demand elections every other Tuesday. Then if a politician reveals himself a lout, we just pick up our cell phones and vote the scoundrel out. You may not see embracing this plan that I propose, but you must be in agreement. It will keep them on their toes. My plan will leave the voters far more blessed than bitter, and maybe even pave the way for monetizing Twitter. Let's do it the way the French used to, by Tarzana Joe.
You know, monetizing Twitter is what Elon Musk is all about. I'm not sure it's possible, Joe. We need a Musk poem from you at some point, because Musk doesn't rhyme with much, does it?
We'll work on it. We'll work on it.
Musk, Tusk. Tarzana Joe business is open for the wedding season. I assume Tarzana Joe at Reagan.com for people seeking versifying. How is business?
Very, very, very good.
Did anyone come in last week and say, I need a poem in a week after you said, please don't do that?
Of course.
Of course they did. Tarzana Joe at Reagan.com. He will not turn you away no matter how late it is in the day.
Thank you, Joe.
That's your job, right? TarzanaJoe.com for all of his poems. TarzanaJoe at Reagan.com if you need help. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, you.
Morning, Glory America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Playing a little Jimmy Buffett music because I was just reading about the Pennsylvania election and I got flashbacks to Florida 2000. Because we're going to have a knife fight over spoiled ballots, etc. It's just going that way. Michael Shear, a veteran New York Times reporter, joins me from inside the Beltway. Hey, Michael, did you cover the 2000 recount?
You know, I didn't. I was still covering state politics at the time in Virginia, so I didn't. I wasn't down in Florida, but I watched it like everybody else. And I do think you're right. There's some eerie similarities there.
Oh my goodness, I've got tattoos from then because every day was a new headline. 25 different lawsuits. David Boies squaring off against Ted Olson. Ted Cruz down there. W running around, James Baker in town, Al Gore. It was wild, but I think Pennsylvania is going that way. So, Michael, the president's in Seoul, Korea. I'm just curious, how did you not draw the short straw and have to go? A lot of people think everybody loves to go on these trips. I'm not sure that's true when you're over 50.
I am over 50, and those trips are exhausting, especially when they're Asia trips with the time change can be tough. I actually drew the straw to go on what they call the advanced trip about a month ago, where the White House and some members of the press go to kind of map out how the trip's going to go. I actually ended up quarantined in Japan for a few days because I had a false positive test. So that was how my trip to Asia went.
How was your time in Japan?
It's great. I love Japan. It was my first time to Tokyo. And, you know, other than spending some of it at in a quarantine barracks at the Yokota Air Base, it was lovely.
You know, I just had a friend get trapped in Spain by a false positive COVID test. I got out of France, thank goodness. So, Michael Scheer, let's talk a little bit about what we learned yesterday. The president is invoking the Defense Production Act on baby formula. Am I correct?
That is true.
Okay. So, do you get to ask a question today?
Do I get to ask a question today?
Yeah.
About, you mean, of the president or?
No, in the press room of Karine.
Oh, well, she's overseas, so there's not going to be a briefing today.
Oh, that's too bad. I have the perfect question.
Okay, what's your question?
If you're going to use the Defense Production Act on baby formula, why don't we use it on gasoline?
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, look, there's a lot of questions. There's a lot of questions about. I wrote in a story today. You know, the White House had a briefing for a bunch of reporters on the Defense Production Act, this baby formula thing. And the thing that was really frustrating is they didn't have any answers. It is very unclear to me still whether there are any issues that companies, that baby manufacturing formula companies have actually put out there that the Defense Production Act would solve, It's certainly a symbolic move. It's certainly, you know, something that gives them some headlines. I'm not sure, even putting aside whether it should be used, I'm not sure whether it actually is going to be used.
Oh, I'm expecting them to have Professor Slughorn come out with a new wand and say, okay, we'll grow ourselves a baby formula factory. You know, the Defense Production Act is you take over factories and you tell them what to make. I don't know how you use it. I know you could use it actually with gasoline, but I don't think you can use it with baby formula. It was absurd.
I mean, there's a part of the Defense Production Act that is short of taking over factories and telling them what to make, which is, which can help with supply chain issues in the ingredients, or the materials that a company needs if you're going to ramp up production. So in theory, I guess it could work. It's just not clear to me that this is a supply chain issue. This is a problem, because of one of the major and one of the only manufacturers of baby formula shut down. It's not clear, and they've provided no real evidence that there is some sort of like supply chain clog that they need to try to unclog.
Oh, no. It was, in fact, Mitch McConnell was on with Brett Baer last night. Let me play you this clip, Michael Scheer, cut number 28.
Almost total incompetence. They misjudged this from the beginning. It's not a matter of money. The FDA has a $6 billion budget. They could certainly take care of the so-called appropriation in the House that they just passed at $28 million. bureaucratic incompetence. The administration was behind the curve. FDA needed to step up their game, and hopefully we'll solve this problem very quickly.
You know, Michael, I practiced administrative law for 30 years with different agencies in the FDA, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Bureau of Land Management, EPA, Army Corps of Engineers. All this was FDA bureaucrats did not want that plant to reopen until they were quadruply certain it wasn't responsible for the infant deaths. And like every bureaucracy, they took forever doing so. So they signed a consent decree to give themselves cover. That's the story. But once they invoked the Defense Production Act, I really do think it's a story that would work with gasoline, because what it allows you to do is blow off permits. That's what the Defense Production Act did with Operation Warp Speed, is that you just blow permits away. And if you want to go to the outer continental shelf, or you want to drill some off of California, you want to open up some lands in Colorado for immediate drilling, DPA could work. I just want to put it in your nesty set of questions for when they come back to the press room.
Okay.
What do you do, by the way, when the president's abroad and there's no presser and you're the White House correspondent for The New York Times? Is it like Wordle time? What do you do?
well, I do try to sneak Wordle in every day regardless. Frankly, it's something of a relief. I have a bunch of interviews set up that with people that often get tied up with the news of the day, and so it's sometimes a breath of fresh air for the president to be on the other side of the world, and you're back here, and you actually get to do some of the work that that is a little bit more long term and a little bit less sort of tied up in the news of the day.
So that is so interesting. The presidency's on the other side of the world. I haven't heard it put that way before, and I think that's exactly what happens, right? It sucks. It's sort of like Night of the Living Dead in the press room, right? Half of them are gone.
Oh yeah, it's if you go to the briefing room and which is obviously where people see the press briefing every day, but also it's the working area of the press corps that's usually jammed, very small, very cramped, and it's usually jammed with people every day. And if you go there today, it'll be very, very quiet. Not only is most of the press gone, but the entire press office, with the exception of a couple of people that are kind of left behind to maintain to mind the store. But it's very quiet over there today.
You know, I want to ask you about one more story. I ran into Mac McClarty during Christmas time. I'd never met him before, but my buddy Garen worked with him. And we chatted amicably, and I thought he is the perfect example of what happens after a presidency goes sideways. You've got to find a sacrifice, right? You got to make a human sacrifice on the gods of D.C.'s altar. And I began to hear for the first time drumbeat about Ron Klain. Did you pick up the tom-toms there?
Well, there have been rumors almost since the beginning, right? There are people who have it out for Klain. I will say I heard a couple of rumors of a couple of weeks ago, what have you, and I did a bunch of reporting, and I at least at the moment was convinced that he doesn't seem to be going anywhere immediately. That, those jobs burn out, have a high burnout rate, and I wouldn't be surprised at some point if Klain leaves. I guess I would think that if they can possibly do it, they would try to put that off until after the midterms. I mean, that's the traditional.
It will be a disaster. It would be a disaster because the one thing this administration is short on is competent, non-ego driven people. And if you get rid of Ron Klain, I will declare the administration over because they're giving up. And they don't have anyone to bring in. It's not like Don Regan is sitting over at Treasury ready to swap jobs with Jim Baker. It's not one of those situations. I mean, we got 1 minute. Indulge me. If you had to, if Ron Klain quit because he's sick of it, and God, I hope he doesn't, who would you want to run the Biden White House?
You know, I appreciate the question. It's probably not for me to answer, even if I could come up with a quick thought. I mean, it's probably not an appropriate thing for me to say. It's not who I want. It's who they want. And I don't know if I agree with you that there's nobody out there that could do the job. Rarely are people irreplaceable. And so, it will be interesting, but I'm going to dodge the question.
Oh, that's okay. But their bench for chief of staff is thinner than their bench for presidential candidates in 2024, meaning non-existent. Michael Scheer, great to talk to you. Follow him on Twitter, Scheer M. Scheer M, one of the reliable guys at the New York Times. Brett Stevens is going to join me on Monday, another one. If you're new to the Hugh Hewitt Show, we talk to everybody, especially great reporters in the White House press room. Stay tuned. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt, joined by Wisconsin Congressman Mike Gallagher. Good morning, Congressman. I have a question for you. When the Brew Crew comes to town, the first place Milwaukee Brewers, which is not really saying much because the Reds and the Pirates are in the NL Central Division, but when they come to town, do you go to Nats Park and do you root for the Brew Crew?
Hugh, I love this universe in which you think I have time when I'm in D.C. to stroll down to Nats Park.
Well, you're a congressman.
You are. That's true. Under Nancy Pelosi's non-existent schedule,
I know.
If I were willing to indulge in the unconstitutional practice of proxy voting, which I'm not, then perhaps I would have time to do that, Hugh. But I have yet to see the Brewers play at National Stadium. I'll put that on my bucket list.
Well, I'll tell you what, they've never been worth seeing, but they're in first place, so don't blink. Congressman, before we go to Ukraine, I have one question for you. You saw that the president invoked the Defense Production Act to produce baby formula yesterday. Did you take note of that?
I did.
Why don't they invoke the Defense Production Act to make gasoline?
Well, first, can I say this idea that the Defense Production Act is going to help us with the baby formula shortage is totally false. They're saying they're going to use it to prioritize ingredients. My understanding is that that's not exactly the issue. What would help far more is flexibility on the so-called WIC rules at the state level, as well as potentially easing import restrictions from trusted partners, whether they're European countries or Australians. And add on to that, the Democrats think that giving the FDA $24 million more dollars after they just got over $100 million is somehow going to fix this. And the FDA can't answer basic questions about it. It's a regulatory problem combined with a lack of leadership problem from the Biden administration, not a lack of money problem or a Defense Production Act problem. As to your specific question on using the DPA for gas, I wonder if that's even necessary. I mean, Biden could stop this crisis by ending the freeze, the federal freeze on new oil and gas leases, fast-tracking pending LNG export permits, expediting approval of all pipeline and energy development, just in general, stopping the regulatory assault on U.S. energy development and financing. Oh, and by the way, kicking all the radicals that are out of FERC, that are in FERC right now, putting a wet blanket on our ability to build energy infrastructure domestically.
Well, I think the DPA is a magic wand. I think it's like Harry Potter. And if they brought it in and did everything under the auspices of the DPA that includes firing FERC, that would work. But I want to go back to the plant for a moment. I did administrative law for 30 years. Here's what happened. Some babies died. It's tragic. They did an investigation. They found some strains of bacteria in the Michigan plant or the, where's the plant? Is it Michigan? I think it's in Michigan. And so it's an Abbott plant. So they shut it down. They did an investigation. Those strains are not the strains that killed the baby, but they kept the plant shuttered because it's the FDA and a bureaucracy and they didn't want to, you know, they're hyper cautious. And the Abbott people got out and said, not us. It's not us. It's not us. Finally, someone called up and said, might have been Ron Klain, and said, reopen the plant. So they did a fake consent decree to pretend that they had done something that hadn't been done for weeks and months beforehand. It's pure bureaucracy. I hope when you get the Congress back, somebody has an oversight into that, because that was just pure administrative idiocy.
Well, my vision for when we take back the House, and I understand we'll still be in divided government. And so, you know, we're probably not going to be passing a lot of transformative legislation. But I think we, using our oversight powers, using those gavels we will have, using the subpoena power we will have, we need to take a look at all the ways in which administrative agencies, federal government agencies, particularly public health related agencies, failed us during the pandemic, and ask hard questions that force these bureaucracies to modernize and perform better in the 21st century, because they're still operating under a 20th century paradigm. And we've just seen so many manifest failures. They're unacceptable. Let me add to that, Hugh. There's a lot of ways in which we waived longstanding regulation for things like telehealth, take your pick, where we need to look back and say, let's just keep it waived permanently. Let's instantiate this into U.S. law. So there's a whole series of things we need to do when we take back the Congress. And I would put it all under the banner of holding people accountable. What my voters get most frustrated with, it's not the lack of this or that particular piece of legislation. It's this growing sense that nobody in the bureaucracy, nobody in the elite political class particularly, is ever held accountable. And until we start holding people accountable for failure, whether it's the FDA, whether it is the general officer class in Afghanistan or the State Department in Afghanistan, whether it's Dr. Fauci himself, I fear we are not going to gain the trust of our voters going forward. We have to inject some accountability into the federal government.
Congressman Gallagher, who will be chair of Armed Services if Republicans win the House back?
Mike Rogers will be chair of Armed Services. Right.
I would like you to relay a request to him for me. I would like two committees, not one. One that takes a look back at Afghanistan and one that takes a look back at Ukraine, because the Ukraine problem goes back to 2012, right? It goes back to Barack Obama closing his eyes to Putin, leaning over to Medvedev and saying, tell Vladimir we can do business after the election, all the way through their occupation of the Donbass. And then Trump gets some scrutiny as well. Trump era. I think Mike Esper slow rolled aid to the Ukraine's armed services during the course of the Trump years, and then this soft power idiocy that we engaged in right up until the invasion. And to today, I read a story this morning that we are thinking about sending Harpoon missiles. I mean, this is May 19th. It's May 20th. We are thinking about sending Harpoon missiles to our European allies to give them to the Ukraine so they can sink the Russian troops that are starving, ships that are starving the world by boycotting Ukraine wheat. I mean, what is going on here?
Well, I agree we need a comprehensive look at both of these issues. But this, Hugh, is actually where your thoughts about the DPA and your thoughts about Ukraine potentially intersect. Because even in a skirmish in which we are not a direct combatant, and which has only gone on for a few months now, we've already exhausted our supplies of certain munitions. So we need to go deep on the supply chain, not just for baby formula, but for missile systems, and figure out how we buy these systems more effectively, how we build them more effectively, so we can replenish our munitions stockpiles rapidly. We're out. We're in the red. And that's for, again, we're not talking about U.S. and China fighting over Taiwan directly. This is U.S. supplying the Ukrainians to fight Russia, and we've already exhausted supplies of javelins and stingers. We have a massive problem in terms of our munitions. The system is blinking red, and that's something we need to solve before it's too late. And that's an area where actually the DPA could be quite effective, and it's true to its original intent.
That is great. I have a third thing I need you to look into when you get the majority back, because I got sent this by a retired Marine Corps.
You got to do commissions. Jeez,
you do. Honest to goodness, I'm not running for Congress ever, but I sure got a list. Yesterday, a retired USMC general sent me a story that I had to read three times because I couldn't believe it. The USS Vicksburg is nearly finished with being modernized, 85% of the way. It's been in dry dock for years. It's a heavy cruiser. We're about to finish spending hundreds of millions of dollars getting it seaworthy for its, you know, midlife thing. And then it's proposed for decommissioning. Now, maybe it needed to be decommissioned. Maybe it needed to be modernized, but it didn't need both. What is wrong with the civilian oversight of the Navy, Congressman Gallagher?
By the way, the reason that we're losing so many vertical launch system tubes in the Pacific over the next 5 years is because we're decommissioning all these cruisers, right? And to your point, this is one that we invested over $200 million in, and the Navy is going to light that money on fire. So what's going on? The Navy's whole theory is that even though their plan wastes money, even though their plan has our Navy bottoming out at about 280, maybe 270 ships at the end of the five-year defense plan window. So think 2027. It's the worst possible moment. We are going to be weakest when China is strongest. That's the end of the Davidson window, when our top admirals are warning us that China may make a move on Taiwan. But the Navy is saying, well, we're going to bottom out quickly, and this will allow us to finally start to rebuild the fleet in the mid-2030s. That's too late. that is too late. Where is the plan for the short term? You know, we tend to think about this competition with China as a long-term marathon. And I get that. And I've used that metaphor myself. And we've all read the Pillsbury book, The 100-Year Marathon. But, and this is a big but, it could manifest itself as a short-term sprint over the next 2 to 5 years.
Okay, the key question, do we need to defend Taiwan? Because my Marine Corps general friend said they're already in the second island chain with the Solomon Island move. So Taiwan doesn't mean Japan falls. I mean, there are lots of assumptions here. Maybe the CNO and his team is actually thinking ahead of us. I'm open to being wrong, Congressman. Does anyone have a plan? I'm just confused as hell, and I'm a civilian.
If they're thinking two moves ahead and their first move is we're going to surrender Taiwan, then that's a bad plan. I would hope to God not. I have been on a 6-year quest to discover and understand the plan to defend Taiwan. There are pieces of a plan that I've uncovered. Nothing is convincing. And when I raise this publicly, some high-profile defense officials say, well, you just haven't been briefed on this spooky secret program or this or that. Bogus, Hugh. Not true. We do not have a simple, coherent plan. We're not moving fast enough. And if we lose Taiwan, fulfilling our treaty obligations to defend Japan becomes extraordinarily difficult, as well as the other treaty obligations we have in the region. You talked about the Solomon Islands as the second island chain. Well, it's Australia's first island chain. So we cannot afford to surrender Taiwan. We are not moving fast enough. Ukraine provides some useful lessons in terms of what we can do to have an effect and what we must do in the short term. But thus far, I have seen no evidence that we're actually learning those lessons.
Do we actually not know what we will do if China makes a move on Taiwan? I mean, is it Mike Gallagher, congressman, member of Armed Services Intel's conclusion that we don't have a plan?
Our official policy is one of strategic ambiguity. So at best, you can say our response will be ambiguous. I don't know. And for those who say for sure we will defend Taiwan, and even President Biden has said that and had to walk it back, would the president have the authority to do it? Would Congress give the president the authority? That's why we need to work through these issues now. I would also clarify our policy of strategic ambiguity and make it certain that we would defend Taiwan, because I think there are real doubts about that fact.
Right? Well, this is a bipartisan mess. There's no clear plan for the Navy. There's no clear plan for Taiwan. And I blame everyone. And I really don't think it's a partisan issue. Last 30 seconds to you, Congressman. It's not a partisan issue.
No. I mean, look at the debate we have on the Sea Power Committee. You know, Joe Courtney and Elaine Luria on the other side are sounding the alarm as well, that myself and Rob Whitman are. So it's going to require a bipartisan solution, one that will transcend different presidential administrations, right? If we win the sprint and then we move on to the marathon, that's a multi-decade competition. It's got to have a bipartisan foundation.
Congressman Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin, Rep Gallagher on Twitter. Thank you, my friend. Have a good morning. I'll be right back on the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Uptown got its hustlers. Bowery got hit bombs. 42nd Street got Big Jim. A walker, he a bull shooting son of a gun. Yeah, he big and dumb as a man can come, but he's stronger than a country horse. And when the bad folks all get together at night, you know they all call Big Jim Ball just because. And they say you don't tug on Superman's cape, you don't spit into the wind, you don't pull a mask of an old Lone Ranger, and you don't mess around with...
We don't mess around with Jim Garrity of National Review. We just like to bring him on and pick his mind. Jim Garrity always can be found at Jim Garrity on Twitter at nationalreview.com, online at NRO. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Doing good, Hugh. I've just told my younger son that don't mess around with Jim, which he knows from Stranger Things. Also, his dad's theme song on the Hugh Hewitt Show.
That
makes me cool, at least as far as...
Yeah, it does. You've got kids are easy to impress. My kids didn't care I was on TV for years until I showed up on the Colbert Show back when he was the crazy conservative, and then all of a sudden they cared. Jim Garrity, give us your assessment. My summary of Pennsylvania this morning is that it's about 10,000 votes uncounted on the Republican side. Dr. Oz is about up 1,100. Could go either way. What do you think?
I think you're correct. Whichever way, this is going to shake out very, very close and be extraordinarily frustrating to the guy who comes in second. My guess is probably going to be within the 0.5% margin of a recount. I certainly, you know, this is one of those cases where it's close enough. I would not oppose a recount or recanvassing. I don't think that would be a sore loser on the part of either man to say, hey, make sure we didn't miss anything. Let's make sure nothing was double counted, something like that. I think right now, it very well could be McCormick. I think right now with Oz ahead, he's slightly more likely. I think if you're Republicans, you're a little frustrated by the fact that this is going to, you know, you'd like to have a nice, clear answer as soon as possible. And whoever wins is going to have to attempt to reunite the party, which I think is not a slam dunk. Although I do think once you can make the argument that Fetterman, a.k.a. White Thanos, as I saw on Twitter this night. Isn't that great? Yeah. He's Bernie Sanders. He looks like he belongs in a biker gang or something. And by the way, I hope sounds like he's making a full recovery and, you know, hope the man lives to be 100. But Pennsylvania should not be represented by a Bernie Sanders type, even if he does, you know, completely not look the part.
No, if you added Bernie Sanders to the Michelin Man and threw in some tats, that's John Fetterman.
Yeah, and, you know, and so I think this is when, you know, either Oz or Fetterman, either Oz or McCormick could win. Between the two, I think it's I would much rather prefer McCormick because I don't think there's anything conservative about Mehmet Oz. I think he's been a Republican for about 20 minutes. But if you give me a choice, you know, between if Oz ends up being the nominee, given the choice between a guy who will vote for Mitch McConnell to be the leader in the Senate and a guy who will vote to make Chuck Schumer the leader in the Senate, it's a slam dunk decision.
Yeah, Kathy Barnett was the worry because she's very charismatic and she also couldn't win. Oz can win. McCormick is a slam dunk in my view. I just think when Pennsylvanians find out a Bronze Star recipient, 82nd Airborne,
yeah,
West Point grad.
Year, yes. Yeah. I mean, there's some people who might say, Fetterman against a hedge fund guy. It's not crazy concern, but I think when, you know, in a good year, in a purple state, McCormick's going to have money. I think you add all that up, it should be a Republican win.
And the Oppo people on the Democratic side are going through every Dr. Oz show. I mean, every single Dr. Oz show ever. And they will have a killer app by the end. He can win. It's just going to be a lot tougher. I endorse McCormick. Everybody knows that. And I told people it might be a one-vote race, and nobody believed me. It might actually be a one-vote race, Jim.
It is. You know, we're down to, like, what, at least 1,000 change. Probably McCormick's going to gain. The remaining outstanding votes are in spots he's done pretty well. So, you know, yeah. But
they got 1,500 military votes coming in. That's what they think is their ace in the hole. That's their shaved knuckle in the hole, as they like to say in the Mazelon trilogy or 10,000 books about the Mazelon world. Jim, in terms of what it says to us about the former president, I wrote a column on this in the Washington Post this week. He hovers. I think he's worth 10%. I also think he consolidates people against him. What's your takeaway after J.D. Vance, after this, after Brian Kemp's going to win in Georgia handily? After Nebraska being a loss for Trump, what's your takeaway?
Hugh, as luck would have it, that is the topic of today's Morning Jolt, because you're going to hear between, you know, Pennsylvania and Georgia coming up next week, you're going to hear a lot of arguments. Trump's endorsement still matters and picks, you know, he's got the Midas touch. He still picks the winners. And people are going to point to Brian Kemp and say no. I think it's safe to say that it is a factor that generally helps a Republican in a Republican primary. But candidate quality matters a lot. And the quality of the opponents matters a lot. So I think your 10% argument is right. I think you can look at J.D. Vance and say, okay, that was a crowded, messy, sharp-elbowed primary. And, you know, for much of the stretch, with a bunch of candidates bouncing around 20-some percent. And in the end, J.D. Vance won by 9 percentage points. That's a clear win.
I am going to go read Morning Jolt, which you can sign up for and get every day sent to you from Jim Garrity. Have a great weekend, Jim, and I'm glad your kids liked your theme song. Jim Garrity on Twitter. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Dr. Larry Oren, the Hillsdale Dialogue is next. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. And I'll be right here. Come back and join us on the next hour of the Friday edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show. We're live in the Beltway.
three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.